And that is something that you do out of habit. The phone rings, you pick it up.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Monday, February 27th. Open a work session on LC 1355 and 2563.
So, Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. It's LC 1355, dated 10-6-16, and LC 2563, dated 12-2-16.
Thank you, Representative Olson. And a reminder that a vote in favor of introducing a legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It is not indicative of a member's opinion or position on the contents of the concept. Representative Olson moves to introduce LCs as committee measures. Is there any discussion? Yes.
I'd like to ask the chair to have the at least brief content of the bills read before we vote.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. LC 1355 allows courts to consider for sentencing as mitigation of sentencing whether defendant was pressured or influenced to commit a crime from a person who committed domestic violence against the defendant. So if a defendant has been a victim of domestic violence and that was a relation to the crime they're being convicted of, that the court consider that for sentencing. And LC 2563 deals with cockfighting and allows for seizure and forfeiture of hens and chicks used in connection with cockfighting and amends the existing offense of forcible recovery of fighting of a fighting bird to include forcible recovery of chicks and hens, and this would be a Class C felony. It's currently a Class C felony, and so the amendments would also be a Class C felony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. No further discussions. Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. The bills are introduced. Next, open a public hearing on House Bill 2597. Call Representative Olson and Mr. Garrett, please.
Do you want me to turn it over to you?
Yeah, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2597 was brought to us by Representative Olson. House Bill 2597 renames the offense of operating a motor vehicle while using a mobile communication device and expands it to cover operating a motor vehicle while using a mobile electronic device. It defines key terms and increases the penalty for a first offense that does not result in an accident to a B traffic violation. Subsequent offenses or a first offense that does result in an accident is increased to an A traffic violation. House Bill 2597 allows a court to suspend the fine on the first offense if the person completes a distracted driving course, and it also eliminates several exceptions contained in the existing law. There is a Dash 2 amendment that was also brought to us by Representative Olson. It expands this offense to include incidents that occur on premises open to the public. It provides for an operative date of October 1st, 2017, and declares an emergency with an effective date of July 1st, 2017. There is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative from the Albany area, and Whitney did an outstanding job of describing exactly what the bill does. So I could probably just close right there, but I won't. But before I go any further from my perspective on this, I'd really like to have the director of the Department of Transportation, Matt Garrett, share with you his sense of urgency, his sense of passion with where we needed to go, and just bring us up to where we're at right now for this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett. I have the privilege of being the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I had the privilege of working with Representative Olson on a distracted driving task force, and that really was the impetus of trying to find a pathway that brings clarity where there's ambiguity today. House Bill 2597, I think, makes critical changes to the Oregon cell phone law to ensure that language matches the capabilities of today's technology, as well as making it clear that any use of a cell phone or a mobile electronic device while driving is not allowed. Simply put, it removes the ambiguity and allows law enforcement to enforce the law. The Oregon Department of Transportation supports passage of this bill because, indeed, it aligns well with several months of work of a distracted driving task force. I had the privilege of sharing the efforts of that task force with a joint Committee of Judiciary a while back ago. But I will remind you a couple things here. The National Highway Transportation Safety Administration defines distracted driving as a specific type of inattention that occurs when drivers divert their attention away from the driving task to some other activity. Distracted driving, I believe, has become pervasive and entrenched in our society. It has become an epidemic facing this country, this state, with increasing fatalities and injuries increasing each year. So what did we do? Again, the Department of Transportation, the Oregon State Police, AAA Oregon-Idaho, we brought together 20 different disciplines, different backgrounds to work together to reduce the fatal and serious injury crashes by changing the cultural norms around distracted driving. The task force engaged in root cause analysis to determine the primary causes of distracted driving here in the state of Oregon. First and foremost, major root cause identified limitations with the current cell phone law, creating difficulties to cite and convict. The Oregon Appellate Court found that the statute prohibits talking and texting on a mobile communication device, but not all activities that can be performed with such a device. This 2015 decision set in motion a change in traffic law enforcement, limiting the use of ORS 811-507 to only cases where the officer witnesses texting or talking with a handheld mobile device. So a policy choice presented itself to us from this court ruling. Should Oregon law related to distracted driving go beyond just talking and texting? Well, House Bill 2597 informs this policy choice as it clarifies definitions, maintains certain inclusions or exclusions, I should say, for ambulance and emergency vehicle operators to use handheld free reductions, as well as a couple more. It increases penalties for scofflaws. It improves enforcement, I believe, and it promotes education. So let me close by saying that House Bill 2597 and the clarity that it brings is one intervention that will have immediate and positive impacts for law enforcement and the courts, and is an important step in curbing distracted driving on Oregon's roads. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to take any questions.
Any questions?
So, Mr. Chair, appreciate coming back again, Andy Olson. Some of you might kind of think, well, what is this all about? I mean, you know, I can't operate a motor vehicle and possibly listen to my music on my radio or, you know, app off of my Apple device here or something like that. You can still use this, your iPhone, if you'd like to, or whatever device you have. But before you start your vehicle and you start driving, you know, and you want to use the GPS system, so I want to determine, okay, how do I get from Albany down to Grants Pass? Or better yet, how do I get to Eastside Portland? I mean, I could get lost up there. You know, I set that into this, and I set it off to the side. That's all. That's how simple this bill is. And I can listen to the GPS system. I can still use this device. I just can't touch it while I'm operating a motor vehicle. There are a couple things that I do want to point out to you that we've had some conversation with, and I do have a, you know, I think it merits probably a little bit further research into it. If you look at page 2 of the bill, actually starting on page 1 of the bill, and I think Representative Post was right in pointing this out to me, as well as Representative Vile for the idea, but it was starting at line 26. Uses the mobile electronic device to communicate if the person, A, is summoning medical or other emergency help if no other person in the vehicle is capable of summoning help. So how does this apply then, you know, to define, and I guess, Whitney, maybe you have a good definition for us for what emergency is, but that would be an issue that would help for us also with the potential of a ham radio operator, as well as for a CB radio operator, as it applies to that. You're going to hear also from the officers that are here today, too, to testify their concerns with call-out type situations on the use of this device as well when they're involved in an emergency situation. So those are all kind of things that we want to share with you. I do like the structure of where we're going. I do have someone here that's going to share a little bit more of the dynamics of that for it. I mean, this is a serious issue. We do have a lot of people that like to drive and not pay attention to what they're doing behind the steering wheel. We had a bill that we were parallel looking at, Mr. Chair, which would bring back memories to you, driving while encumbered type concept. But we chose not to go that direction with that, and because of the main focus of what the Court of Appeals did with our bill last year, or our law that existed last year. I do like the structure of the first conviction being able to go through an education process and then having that fine dismissed, potentially left up to the discretion of the court. The second time within a 10-year period of time obviously changes the game on that. It moves it to a Class A traffic infraction. It's a Class A traffic infraction as well as if you're involved in a motor vehicle accident and to determine that this was a causation for that. So the group that was there, there was a lot of folks. We met a lot of times. I like the structure of where this is going. Do I think, Mr. Chair and committee members, it may need a little bit more attention in some areas? I do at this point. But this, we do need most definitely to go this direction.
Okay, thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill. I actually, what was it, 6 years ago when this originally passed, I actually voted no then because I could see some issues that were not defined, and I thought it was going to be tough on law enforcement, and so I'm glad to see some of that tightened up. So it sounds like the change, the most significant change, I'm not talking about what to do on first and second convictions, but the most significant change is holding the device. Is that correct?
That would be correct. You can't, you're not going to be able to operate a motor vehicle with something like any type of electronic device in your possession.
Okay. Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not trying to parse out and see what a person can get away with and not get away with. I'm looking at an enforcement standpoint here. So my husband and I recently bought a vehicle. It's really kind of cool. We haven't bought a new vehicle since we've been married. It's been a long time. And the controls are on the steering wheel. I plug in my phone because maybe I want to listen to Pandora or something, and I throw it in the console when I get in the car, and I usually don't even touch my phone until I'm done. But I can text or call or whatever just with my hands on the steering wheel and use Siri. How does that work?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Springer, that is the catch on this thing. It does not apply, to where we're wanting to go. It because what you've just described is manufactured into the vehicle.
Yeah.
That's off limits.
With the follow-up?
For the violation.
Okay. So that's still allowed?
That would be correct.
Okay.
And I have three sergeants in the back, too, that can really kind of give you a good perspective, too, of what they've seen. And one of them was involved with our work group. So,
okay. Thank you.
Representative Vile.
Mr. Chairman, I've kind of got the same question I'm trying to understand. In on page 1 in line 22, the violation is holds a mobile electronic device in the person's hand or uses a mobile electronic device for any purpose. And I'm curious, as I think Representative Springer was, as to whether or not that precludes me from using. I just bought a 2017 car, first new car in 15 years myself, and it's got all the good technology on it, but sometimes to answer a call, I may have to reach up and touch a button.
Mm-hmm.
Or to make a call out, I touch a button and it asks me what I want to do, and I tell it. I am certainly using a mobile electronic device at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It is being used through the car. Unless I touch the button on the phone, mine I attach to my dashboard, and then it talks to the video display in my dash. But I got to either touch that video display or touch the phone to answer a call in some circumstances. Are you suggesting that maybe the changes you would be looking at making would clarify that that is not going to be a violation when you're doing the best you can to use the CARS system, but it may still involve touching the phone and you are using the mobile device?
Yes, so Mr. Chair and Representative Vile, you bring a good point, but I don't feel it's necessary to go anywhere there with the change, especially with what the definition is of a mobile electronic. And then when you take a look at both under subsection 2, actually it's lines 22 and 23. So if it's permanently attached and where the manufacturer had placed it in the vehicle, you'd be exempt from where we're wanting to go in the statute.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I understand that that's the intent, but the lawyer in me says I can see this happening where the judge tosses a case because I brought this thing to the car. It wasn't built into the car. And the way this is written, I can imagine that there may be those that would interpret that as, this is what I'm using. It just happens to be using through the car, and this says, I can't use this.
Yeah. So again, Mr. Chair and Representative Vile, during this work group, which I didn't identify, we had four judges. We had two circuit court judges, one justice of the peace, and also a municipal court judge that were involved in this for the direction, because we really tried to kind of just flush this out the best we could out of all the different angles. I think also some of your questions might be answered with the three sergeants from different agencies that are here, because obviously they're the ones that are going to be seeing the violations of the law out on the road, and how they're interpreting this and how you move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Greenlee.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Olson, does a mobile electronic device include an electric razor?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, you're asking the question about whether or not you can use a portable razor to shave while you're operating a motor vehicle?
Whether you can is what I was worried about. It's unlikely I will be.
Well, that would have fit really well into the one bill that we were kind of looking at paralleling this whole issue.
I've seen people driving down the road shaving, and it strikes me as terrible.
I know. We might come back, but I hear you.
Representative Post.
Thank you. First, Mr. Chair, thank you. First, one question for Mr. Garrett. Just could you go back to the quote you read? I think it was from the NTSB, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Distracted driving is and you said specific, something, you used the word specific there.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Post, it's from the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, NHTSA.
Okay.
And again, they define it as a specific type of inattention that occurs when drivers divert their attention away from the driving task to focus on another activity. And I think just to boil it down, NHTSA wants to ensure that people keep their hands on the wheel and keep their eyes on the road. So it's just that simple.
Follow up then. Okay, well, based on that, I mean, I've been receiving a lot of calls and emails on this bill where people are asking me to amend it, which I wasn't here 6 years ago when you guys worked on this once before, and I would have said the same things then. You just said specific that distracts me from driving. Representative Greenlee has mentioned one thing. I can think of, I'm sure the sergeants can point out 100 things that people do while they're driving that are stupid. Cheeseburgers, mascara, lipstick, reading. I've seen people reading books and magazines, driving 65 miles an hour down the highway. Why are we focusing just on cell phones, which seems to be last time, 6 years ago, and again this time? Why just cell phones, or in this case, possibly CBs and ham radios? I would like to see, if we're going to do this, let's do it right. If a person can't drive without their hands on the wheel, period, take away their license. Now, I know that's extreme, but you see where I'm going? There's way too many distractions, way too many. So my question for you is, but specifically from NHTSA, Isn't that what they're saying? Anything that distracts should go away.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Post, legitimate issue to be argued. But I'll tell you the focus of our conversation dealt with the ambiguity that came out of a court case. And I think you have to take these things one at a time. There's not a perfect solution to this. I think you could continue to argue this for a long time. But what we know with the vehicle we have in front of us, House Bill 2597, which, again, has the insight, the counsel, and the critique from law enforcement, the courts, safety professionals, academicians, researchers, AAA, as well as the Oregon Department of Transportation and a cross-discipline set of professionals here, is we need to remove the chilling effect that an appellate court case had, and let's move forward on that. Let's clear that up so law enforcement can cite and the courts can adjudicate. That's the first step. I don't doubt that we have additional conversations to engage in, but I think this vehicle allows a good first step that will make it just a little bit safer on the highways and byways in the state of Oregon.
Okay, thank you very much. Next, I'll call Robert. I'm sorry. Representative Stark had a question.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I just wanted to double check and.
Are you wanting me to sit back down?
Please. Repulsion, I was wondering if this would.
Could you speak up into the mic, please? Thank you. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Repulsion.
Chair.
I'm wondering if this might answer Rep. Vile's question. You know, page 1, verse 20, or no,
verse 20. thank you, Reverend. Monday, it's Monday.
Wrong day of the week. Line 20, now where am I? Thank you. 24, this section does not apply to a person who, and then if you go down to line 5 of page 2, is 18 years of age or older and is using a hands-free accessory. Wouldn't that apply to the idea that, you know, yes, you can still have your phone there, but your steering wheel is now a hands-free accessory, or your Bluetooth is a hands-free accessory? Wouldn't that somewhat kind of resolve that question?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Stark, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Representative. Next, I'll call Robert Hayes, Todd Moquin, and Clayton Simon.
Chair Barker and members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Robert Hayes. I'm a sergeant with the Albany Police Department. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police to support the passage of House Bill 2597. As a background, I'm a certified drug recognition expert and a drug recognition expert instructor. I'm also a crash reconstructionist. In my 25 years as a police officer, I have conducted numerous investigations in regards to motor vehicle crashes. I teach part-time at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The classes I instruct are related to impaired driving and crash investigations. I am also the chair for the State of Oregon DUII Multidisciplinary Training Task Force. This task force provides training to all disciplines throughout the state in regards to impaired driving. House Bill 2597 addresses a Court of Appeals ruling on ORS 811-507 mobile communication device in the case of State versus Rombatales Romas that is resulting in numerous citations being dismissed in courts around the state. Based on the ruling, to issue a citation for a violation of using a mobile communication device, an officer must have probable cause to believe that a person operating a motor vehicle is talking or talking on their phone or texting. The purpose of the mobile communication violation statute was intended to prohibit vehicle operators, with exceptions, from using their cell phone device while driving. This ruling focuses on talk and text, but would allow drivers to play games, read and reply to emails, and surf the web. The National Safety Council estimates about 1 in 4 motor vehicle crashes involves a cell phone use at the time of the crash. While drivers can be distracted by many things while operating a motor vehicle, the use of a cell phone combines all three of the main types of distracted driving, including visual, taking your eyes off the road, manual, taking your hands off the wheel, and cognitive, taking your mind off of driving. House Bill 2597 includes the following key provisions. Changes the term mobile communication device to mobile electronic device to ensure that the use of a phone, iPad, computer, etc. are covered. For purposes of this measure, a mobile communication device includes but is not limited to a device capable of texting a message, voice communication, entertainment, navigation, accessing the internet, or producing electronic email. Clarifies that using a mobile electronic device includes but is not limited to using mobile electronic device for text messaging, voice communication, entertainment, navigation, accessing the internet, or producing electronic emails. For the first-time offenders, this bill allows the court to conditionally suspend the execution of the fine and pending successful completion of an approved distracted driving avoidance course to suspend the fine altogether. As the use of cell phones and other electronic devices continue to increase, the prevalence of traffic crashes that result in injury and death are increasing at an alarming rate. The work of police officers to enforce these laws is critically important, both to create incentives for voluntary compliance and to identify dangerous driving behaviors before injury or death occurs. Thank you, and I'm glad to answer any questions after the other two testify.
Yeah, go ahead. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, representatives. My name is Clayton Simon. I'm a law enforcement officer with the City of Lake Oswego. I'm a sergeant out there. I've worked in law enforcement for 12 years, several of which were as a motorcycle officer in the traffic division. I'm an accident reconstructionist and have conducted a great deal of proactive and highly visible enforcement to address traffic safety issues. I've worked individually and as part of an interagency team to investigate minor, serious injury, and fatal traffic collisions. Over the years, I've contacted countless drivers for all kinds of unsafe and distracted driving behavior and offenses, many of which were related to cell phone use. My hope continues to be that proactive enforcement can play a substantial role in reducing traffic accidents and keeping our citizens safe. As a supervisor, I've seen my officers seek out opportunities to address unsafe driving behavior with the goal of increasing safe and courteous vehicle operation. To be successful here, it is necessary to have a clear view of the law and how it is to be applied. House Bill 2597 provides ideal clarity in this regard. It specifically recognizes the never-ending and supercomputer-like capabilities of our currently handheld smart devices. It understands these electronic devices are used for more than just talking and texting. They are used for satellite navigation, email, social media browsing, internet surfing, all kinds of tailored applications. It's an electronic device capable of keeping us all connected and engaged within our local and distant communities. Unfortunately, the timing for this engagement can come with great risk to ourselves and those we care about, and even innocent strangers, none more so than when a motorist decides to use those devices while driving. We've all seen those risky situations. We've seen the vehicle driving well below the speed limit, or the one that randomly speeds up and slows down. We've seen the vehicles fly past stop signs and blow through traffic lights. We've watched vehicles weave back and forth across the roadway. We've seen them fail to signal a lane change, and we've seen them bump into parked cars and parking lots. And we've all sat behind that one vehicle that sits at a green light for minutes on end and doesn't move. We see this and think the driver must be impaired, and we get a decent look and we see them that they're looking at the cell phone in the hand or the light glow coming from their lap. We see how distracted they are when using their smart devices while driving, unaware of what is happening around them, and we all know how dangerous this can be. In 2014, over 3,000 people were killed and over 400,000 people were seriously injured in distracted driving related offenses here in the United States. As an accident investigator, I've seen too many instances where vehicles drive off the roadway, slam into the back of another stopped car, or worse, an unprotected pedestrian. Law enforcement responds to these violent collisions, and we talk to the driver, and they often can't give a reason for why the crash occurred. We hear things like, "I looked up, and the car was stopped, and there it was." But yet when we ask what they were looking down at to not see the car stopped ahead of them, we're never really given a really good explanation. It's clear to accident investigators these drivers are distracted, and I believe our smartphones play a significant role in that distraction. As was already mentioned about the appeals case, State v. Rubinales Ramos, this severely limited our ability to address the current use of smart devices while driving. In our municipal court in Lake Oswego, unless we see the driver's mouth moving and their fingers actively typing and texting, and we can prove that it's texting, we cannot enforce the current cell law. And motorists can drive down the road surfing the internet, playing a game, or posting live on social media, and is not a violation of this current cell law. At my agency in Lake Oswego, once this Court of Appeals case came through, the following year we saw a 60% drop in warnings and citations written just for this violation. Looking around, and
We've all been out on the road, and we can see this is not because there are fewer people on their phones. House Bill 2597 accurately assesses the many capabilities of our smart devices. It gives law enforcement proper guidance for enforcement. It clarifies the allowances and expectations of use for our motorists. And for motorists contacted because of that device use, it creates educational opportunities to reduce future distracted driving behavior. So as a law enforcement officer, husband, and a father, I support House Bill 2597 and the clarity it seeks, and I hope you will too. And I'm happy to answer any questions when you're ready.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Todd Moquin. I'm a sergeant with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I'm here on behalf today of the Oregon State Sheriff's Office Association and Sheriff Myers to support the House passage of House Bill 2597. As background, I'm a sergeant in charge of the Marion County Sheriff's Office Traffic Safety Team and the Crash Reconstruction and Scene Homicide Crash Team. I've been a police officer for over 22 years and spent several years in traffic enforcement as a motor deputy and 10 years in narcotics enforcement. I have conducted numerous investigations into motor vehicle crashes, with my crash team focusing on the criminal DUI crashes and homicide crashes. I'm an active committee member with the ODOT Law Enforcement Traffic Safety Advisory Committee, and also worked on House Bill 2597 with Representative Olson. National Center Council estimates that one in four motor vehicle crashes involve cell phone at this time of the crash. I estimate this number is very low due to the fact that most citizens do not self-report that they were actually on their cell phone. Well, when a non-injury, non-blocking crash occurs, law enforcement does not usually respond. And if we do respond, it's usually just to clear the scene and immediately open up the roadway. The detailed depth of the investigation is minimal unless it's a fatality or a criminal charge crash. My traffic team estimates one in every three drivers that are using a cell phone are also violating another law, such as speeding, falling too close, failing to maintain lane, not signaling, and all this is due to the distracted of being on the cell phone. Our statistics within the Sheriff's Office shows the majority of the cell phone violators are between the ages of 25 and 45 years of age. These individuals have been driving for several years and feel that they know how to operate a vehicle and drive with a cell phone while doing it safely. Having the distracted driving course available in this House bill or in the law would allow these people to be educated that what they're doing is actually pretty dangerous out there on the highways. Several issues that have come up in this House bill that I would like to address. The language was put in that we operate an ambulance or emergency vehicle while acting in the scope of a person's employment as far as medical field or law enforcement. Often police officers are on duty 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. On call, we have SWAT guys, we have detectives. I'm on call for the crash team for any times. Often I'm in my personal vehicle when I get these phone calls. If we pass it this way, we're going to have a problem. The fact is I'm then violating the law, which is not something we want to do. We also have on the sheriff's office, we have our search and rescue teams. We have hundreds of volunteers that are called up into the woods. At times they are often used cell phones, their radios inside the vehicles. When they're acting in search and rescue capacity, they're volunteers, they're not police officers. We need to allow them to do that. And oftentimes it's not necessarily the woods. As just recently in Portland, they had the missing two-year-old and the search and rescue volunteers were out there and able to find that child. I'm available for any questions.
Okay, any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate your expertise showing up down here for that. Next, I call Robert Swan and Judge Cooper. Judge Cooper? You can go in any order, just please remember to identify yourself for the record. Would you like to?
Oh, Jerome Cooper, also known as Jerry Cooper. I'm a recently retired circuit court judge pro tem from Multnomah County.
If you want to go ahead.
You want me?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
I'm a member of the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee, statutory committee appointed by the governor for the last 12 years, and I was a participant in the task force. And Stephen Todd, another pro tem circuit court judge, myself represented the circuit courts. And then we had John Mercer from Beaverton Municipal Court, and we had
Jedlam House.
Yeah, he's a justice of the peace from Linn County. So I'm just being kind of a technician, I think, more than anything else. I'm in full support of the bill. Because I was going to retire, I was put on the duty of having to look at all of these cases when people were cited. Was there probable cause to stop them? And if there was, the case would proceed. If there was not, it was over. It was dismissed on a search and seizure issue. It was an improper stop. And everything from that point on was tainted. So because I was going to retire, I took on that issue. And I've heard a lot of different, you know, versions of what's going on. I think this bill is going to deal with the matter at hand. You have to define what usage is going to be. The original bill just said you can't use, but it didn't have any statutory definitions as to what use meant. And your legislative history, the way it was interpreted by the Court of Appeals, was very limited, very restricted. It has to be for talking or texting, nothing more, nothing less. And this bill is going to allow a lot more breadth to cover the issues at hand. And I was the person on this task force that wanted to have premises open to the public. Now, careless driving is a Class B violation. It applies to premises open to the public. And this is a situation where ABC a couple of months ago put on specials showing people driving in the parking lots very fast, not checking to see if anyone was backing out because they weren't looking, and they would be bouncing around like ping pong balls. And so it was my impression that we needed to expand the coverage from public highways to include premises open to the public. On one of these issues, on the enhancement, it says the original bill spoke in terms of prior offenses. Second offense or subsequent, it's an A violation versus a B. Conviction is, I think, is a little bit better. It means that you've been convicted, it's on your driving record, everybody knows. A prior offense could mean that the person's been cited, they have had their case dismissed because the police officer did not appear, but that's a prior offense. And it could be then someone in a small community might know about what was going on from the police standpoint or and be trying to use that to enhance. So I think conviction is the way to do it. DMV is going to keep the records. This bill has this provision for diversion, for first-time offense. So I was going to focus on this for a second so you understood exactly what was intended. I tried to get DMV to allow for an entry on the records for diversion. They couldn't do it. They did it for DUI diversion for DUII. And I was the legislative chairman for the District Attorneys Association. I was chief deputy in Washington County back in 1983. We got it done, but now, 30 years later, they can't do it. So my approach was they would be convicted, there'd be a fine imposed, and if they take this class, if they're eligible, the fine can be suspended in its execution. The judge would impose a fine, and then it could be suspended in all or part based upon the agreement with the court. And so we've set for 120 days out for the first-time offender that they can show proof that they've completed. Being former trial court administrator in Multnomah County for 2.5 years, I came up with the idea if they can show sooner than within 120 days, the court on its own motion can do the suspension and not have to make the people come in. In Multnomah County, we just couldn't have a courtroom full of people showing up constantly to prove they had taken the course when we knew well in advance that was the case. So, again, that's just kind of trying to be efficient, I guess, in court administration. But overall, I think this bill does do a good job. It's my impression, being a judge who heard so many of these cases, in the last 2 years, after the Rabana, I call it the Ramos case. I'm not even going to try to remember the hyphenated name. But in the Ramos case, because it became such a problem for the police, and I think they have said, as long as you can't have it, you can't have it in your hand or on your lap. Now, you can talk about possession, but I think it's if people do drive with on their laps, looking down, Yeah, and I think that needs to be restricted as well as in your hand, however you want to define that issue. But overall, I believe this bill is going to do the job. It's going to meet the federal requirements for funding by limiting the folks who get the exemptions. And so I can just tell you, as a person who's had quite a bit of experience in dealing with the applications of this area, that this is a vast improvement. Now, it only deals with the cell phone. I agree. There's other types of distractions. Dogs on the lap, at their feet, eating, using mirrors to put on makeup, to be reading a newspaper, going down I-5, just as in perfect condition, no mistakes. But I used to see it when I was the lead instructor at the police academy in Monmouth for 12 years, and I had people in the middle lane of I-5 going right down, sailing along within the speed limit, not too following too close, and perfect control. But I just thought, police officer has to give them a pass on that, and then they're going to wait until they do something crazy, because it's going to happen. Eventually, it's going to happen. Why can't the officer intervene as soon as possible? So that's another area of concern. But I think the task force, just speaking on my own behalf, felt that we didn't want to endanger this bill with some other activity that could be a distraction. And let's take care of this, because it's on the books, as pointed out by Officer Spencer. And let's fix it as best we can. And then there's going to be nuances, and we're going to have to address those as well.
Thank you, Judge. Please.
Hi, my name is Robert Swan. I live in Albany. I have a PhD in public policy and a master's in criminology. My previous experience as a college professor of policing and criminal justice informs what I'm going to talk about today. In my previous experience, most of my work was with gang management, neighborhood building, community building, and at this point, you're like, why are you here? So what I really want to talk about, and what I'm trained in, what I understand through my experiences researching corrections and sanctioning in a variety of ways, are the sanctions. In fact, I haven't been on the work committee. I pulled myself into this in December when I started to see these bills proposed that would offer first strike felonies, multi-$1,000 fine. It was alarming to me. Normally, I don't get pulled into a cell phone bill. But understanding deterrence, deterrence theory, research on deterrence, and where we're trying to go with deterrence in a bill like that was very alarming to me. It felt like we were going backwards. So I contacted Representative Olson. He phoned me right back. We started to work on that. So for me, my interest here is in the way the sanction is structured. And I support this bill primarily because the sanction is structured in such a way that it'll be far more effective deterrent at the specific sense. So it'll be a much more effective specific deterrent. It probably will have some general deterrent effect, but that assumes everybody will know what the law is, which is why general deterrence tends to not pan out so well. But as far as the way and that's true for the previous bills I saw in December and January, I thought there will not be the anticipated general deterrence effect. In fact, who is going to tend to, even if given the knowledge, you're still going to have a certain demographic with impulse control issues wind up getting felonies. And I pictured all of my friends' teenagers going down on a felony, you know, in the extreme bill that I saw in December. And then you have these fines. Anyway, it began to get to me. I couldn't think about anything else, so I got a hold. So going back to this, as far as specific and general deterrence, I think the goal here is to reduce behavior, right? We're not going to eliminate this ultimately. But you can reduce this, I think, with 2597. The way those sanctions are structured, I think you will be able to significantly reduce this behavior. Certainly, there was a redemptive. I heard somebody mention redemption and some other components. But more important than redemption is the training. I heard people talk about education, learning how this, you'd be, maybe you wouldn't be surprised, but in my classes, and I've taught thousands and thousands of students, I stop being surprised, I guess, over time at what people don't know. And they don't know quite a bit. So in this case, I think this is a great way to teach a new norm. We're establishing a new norm. And that's hard. That's hard work. You see that with the firearm stuff. You see that in a lot of different domains, trying to establish a new culture, a new set of norms, and we're codifying those here formally. I think rather than going heavy-handed, boot on the neck, felony, one-strike felony fines, I think this is a much more gentle and effective way to deal with sanctions, to teach the new norm, to educate people across space and time about what we're concerned about here. And I'm here really as a constituent who was freaked out by the initial reports of the bills coming out of the legislature being proposed, and I'm just here to support this in that narrow area of sanctioning. I support the way the sanctions are structured, and that's what I'm here to say. So thank you for that opportunity.
Any questions, please? Yes, Representative Miles.
Judge, in the Robin Ellis Ramos case, that was essentially a situation where, because the trial court determined that in fact the initial stop wasn't based on clear probable cause, because you couldn't really tell whether somebody was using the phone to talk on it or to look at your navigation or whatever it might be, then the rest of that, which in that case was an intoxicated driver,
right,
all of that was tossed out. And so I can understand where law enforcement would have a real concern that that had been the result. What's troubling me is that still, in spite of Representative Stark's observations, when I read this bill, if it were passed today and became effective today, I don't know what I could do tonight on my way home back up to Shoals. I've got an hour's worth of driving. I've got a cell phone that the moment I step into my car and turn it on, it connects to my hands-free device. Mm-hmm. But if somebody calls me, I've still got to reach up and touch it. I've still got to do something to answer that call. If I want to call out on it, I've either got to ask it to look up a phone number and then choose which one of those phone numbers I want to talk to. And as I read the language here, in spite of the fact that it says 18 years of age using a hand-free device, prior to that it specifically says you simply can't use the mobile device. The inconsistency in those two statements causes me to wonder if we wouldn't end up in exactly the same place we are today with another stop, because the bill is internally inconsistent. And as a judge, that's a tough place to be when somebody challenges the stop. Am I not correct?
That's true. But it's the idea is to keep it simple. And the simplicity would be no touching. You can't, you're hands-free. And so once you're in the car, you're stuck.
So that would be, if you were looking at a case that came before you right now, that would be the threshold.
Yes.
Did the person touch anything?
That's right.
Did they have to use their hand at all?
That's right.
Whether it was the phone or the display in the car or a button on the steering wheel?
No. Representative, okay, I mean, Mr. Chair. Okay, again, you're splitting hairs here, I think, Representative Vile. Again, one more time, there's a difference between the device being handheld versus that of what's been actually manufactured into the vehicle.
Well, I Mr. Chairman, I agree that I think that's what we're trying to get to. I'm suggesting, and that's why the colloquy with the good judge here, I'm not sure that this language gets us there, and I think we've just illustrated that. For the court to say, no, the way I read it, it's no touch. The way Representative Olson maybe reads it, it's no. If it's the hands-free portion in the vehicle, maybe you can touch. I think it's critical. If we're actually going to solve the problem, I think it's critical that we eliminate that ambiguity, or we're going to be exactly right back where we are today. And I think that would be a shame and a misuse of resources. So that's my point, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative Olson has already said they would like to do some more work on it so they could probably figure out how to clear up that ambiguity.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, Judge. Good to see you again. Okay. I'll put them on there. Okay. Craig Campbell, David Sale, and Darla Sturdy. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA Oregon. We're in support of House Bill 2597, and I'd want to start by thanking Director Garrett to allow us to participate in the Distracted Driving Task Force. AAA is three-fourths of the way through a groundbreaking study on cognitive distraction. We've released three phases of that study, and it's that to which I wanted to talk about today because it does have an impact on the legislation that you have in front of you and actually a little bit beyond that. The study essentially identified what is the cognitive impact of distracted driving on the driver under a series of different circumstances, from driving with your actual talking on your phone, hands-free, and a variety of different auditory-activated devices in the car that have become available in the last couple of years. Representative Post and a number of others who have testified today have talked about the other kinds of distractions that occur to us in the road, whether we have a pet in our lap or we're talking or we're eating a hamburger or we're doing whatever we're doing. Those all deal with distractions where either our eyes or our hands sometimes are not in complete control of the vehicle. And what the studies talk about is those circumstances where you actually have your hands on the wheel and you have your eyes on the road, and you're still distracted. Most of the communication devices that we use that are hands-free don't address the cognitive problem that you are distracted from what is going on around you and you were not fully able to engage in driving as long as that distraction occurs. And there's a transition time from when you stop using that device, whether it be through your manufactured car or through a hands-free device. It can take up to 27 seconds for your brain to fully re-engage in the road. Unfortunately, my wife and children have to deal with this every time I'm watching a television show and they want to engage my attention by asking me a question. If they're lucky, they only have to ask three times. But it does take the brain some time to get back. Now, to give you an indication, if it takes me 27 seconds, and granted, that's the outside range, a car going 25 miles per hour travels 990 feet, three football fields, before I'm fully mentally engaged in the road again. So this bill is a good start in trying to address distracted driving, but the reality is hands-free is not carefree. It still is a problem in the road. There was an old saying we used to have in Homeland Security, we are safer than we were before, but we are not yet safe. This bill makes us safer as drivers, but we're not yet fully safe. Now, of course, it's very difficult to legislate everything that we do in our cars. Free will is a real important thing, but just understand that this goes the right direction, but the studies that we've done have indicated that we still have safety issues beyond just the hands-free opportunities involved in driving. And with that, I'll answer any questions you may have. Thank you very much.
Please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for letting me be here today. My name is Darla Sturdy, and my son is Aaron Wagner Sturdy. And he was a great kid. He played 9 years of football, 7 years of baseball, fourth in the nation in Taekwondo when he was nine, and he did drama, and he was also involved in his youth group. One day he was headed home from youth group, and he was going to cross a crosswalk, and the light rail hit him on that crosswalk. She honked 3 seconds before she hit him. So obviously she was distracted if she waited for 3 seconds. My son was alive under the train, and TriMet doesn't call 911, so it went to dispatch. So they got there first, and by the time they brought a new driver and took the other driver off the train and backed it back up, he died from suffocation. He actually wasn't hurt any part of his body, but a little bruise right here. There also was an ambulance there. I just want to throw this in, and they didn't send him off in the ambulance. They put him off to the side, and he laid there for 2 hours before they took him down to the coroner's office. In 2007, I actually came here, and I passed a law, and it was against TriMet to go back to every single crosswalk throughout the entire light rail line. And so in 2008, I went in front of the board of directors for TriMet and asked them how the law was coming. Well, they didn't know about the law. TriMet hadn't told the board of directors. So in 2009, I came back here, and they ended up having to change 80 crosswalks and 45 stations. And they said they would fix where my son was killed first. 6 months later, they killed the person where my son was killed, and then they fixed it a week later. So with that, I actually asked TriMet, since they hit 505, to take 20 out of that 505 and send it to the National Safety Board. And so they picked them, and we sent them, and one out of every four they judge incorrectly because they judge their own accidents. Sorry. It's this distraction of the driver. You know, we're talking about being distracted by a lot of things. But you know what? It's a start. And we have to start somewhere. And I'm on almost 14 years later that my son died. And you know, we have to be able to have something or make some accommodations and move this forward. Also, too, this is kind of with also House Bill 2667. Which is a task force to oversee these agencies so we do things correctly and be able to follow. But I hope that you will support this bill today and pass it on. And I appreciate your time to listen to me.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. I'm sorry for your loss, and I really appreciate you being able to come down and share that with us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for allowing me to be here today. My name's David Sale. My daughter Danielle was hit in a crosswalk, excuse me, back in 2010 from a TriMet bus driver. Took an illegal left-hand turn from a right-hand curb lane, ran over five people in a crosswalk, and they were in the crosswalk on a green light meant to be seen. That driver drug them 60 feet, backed over them, put the bus in drive again, drove over them again, and then turned the bus off, and it kneeled on top of them. My daughter actually was trapped in the right-hand wheel well of that bus. And her friend Janae, who's pictured with her on the side, was underneath the left rear wheel while that driver did those things. Now, I don't know what the definition of distracted driving is to the T, and I don't think that's really the point today. I think today we need to do something. And I'm begging you, on behalf of my family and every family with Families for Safe Streets in Oregon, Southwest Washington, that we be proactive and not reactive. The reaction time's over with. It's time to be proactive. If we're talking about 15, 20 years ago, what'd we do with cell phones and devices before that? I was an outside salesman for many years, and my office was the cab of my truck. I know what it's like to have a brick phone. I know what it's like to be distracted, because I'm not innocent of any of those. But I also know if you can't deal with driving and being on a hands-free device, then pull over. There's plenty of places to pull over. There's an exit ramp every 5 or 6 miles. If you're in a hurry to drive an hour, sorry about that. Turn your phone off. If you're in a hurry to get anywhere, pull over. If you got to use that phone, pull over. So, again, this is a time to be proactive, not reactive, regardless of whether we have to amend this bill or whatever we have to do. We have to do something. And currently, we're not doing anything. So please bring it to everyone's attention, and I really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you for coming down and sharing that. And it's my intention to move the bill, but we do need to get it fixed so it makes
absolutely.
So it's legally right. The law, as you well know, is so technical. If we have the wrong word in there, it doesn't work. So we want to get it all fixed before we send it on.
Absolutely, and I appreciate you doing that. Representative Olson, thank you for bringing it to the forefront.
Thank you. Are any questions from anybody? Thank you very much, panel. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Former Seaman, John Corr, and Courtney Seipel. I probably mispronounced those, but. And you go in any order, but please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak to you today on an important topic related to ham radio use, related to House Bill 2597. As the Oregon section manager
you need to give your name for the record.
My name is John Corr.
Thank you.
I am the Oregon section manager for the American Radio Relay League, which is the National Association for Amateur Radio, and I represent about 3,500 licensed amateurs here in the state of Oregon. There are about 18,000 in total within the state of Oregon that hold FCC amateur licenses that would be affected by this legislation. Many of us use our ham radios in our vehicles to support public service events. As you may know, from the Hood to Coast relays to Cycle Oregon to Portland Marathon and many other events during the year. In addition, there are about 600 amateurs that support local, county, and state emergency management, as well as some search and rescue teams with auxiliary emergency communications requiring the use of radios in our vehicles. This volunteer use of mobile radio is critical to many government and non-governmental organizations here in Oregon. And in the event of a large-scale disaster, this mobile communications capability would be an essential component of our service to those organizations that we support and the people of Oregon. I will be testifying tomorrow before the House Committee on Disaster Preparedness on auxiliary communications. That is proven to be really critical to the state. House Bill 2597 would remove the exemption that FCC licensed amateurs now have under the current law. Removal of the exemption will also serve as a significant disincentive for amateurs to install and maintain radios in their vehicles, and for that reason we are requesting that the members of this committee consider restoring the exemption in the current law by adding the following language: holds a valid amateur radio license or any other license issued by the Federal Communications Commission and is operating an amateur radio. The state of Washington legislature recently restored this exemption in their distracted driving regulations in Washington House Bills 1371 and Washington Senate Bill 5289, and our hope is that members of this committee will consider some similar actions. Thank you for considering our request and supporting those who depend on amateur radio operators for communications at times when they're needed most.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Courtney Seipel, representing the Oregon Trucking Associations today. Bob Russell from OTA has submitted some written testimony, and that should be available on OLIS, but I did want to highlight a couple of points that Mr. Russell made in his testimony. First of all, safety is our number one concern for our industry, so we do appreciate the intent of the bill. However, the way it's drafted, we do have a few concerns. The Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration has required most trucks to have electronic logging devices installed by December of this year. So our members have been working quickly to incorporate that technology into their trucks, and this bill would directly counter that federal mandate. Secondly, our members also utilize handheld radio devices as well as navigation systems. And the way the bill is drafted, we're concerned that those might fall under the mobile electronic device definition. Again, we do support the intent of this bill, so we'd be very happy to work with the committee to address the concerns outlined today. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. Similar to the some of the other testimony, we're supportive generally of the concepts within the bill, but we've got some concern with the language in particular. Specifically, what we're concerned about is the bill references operating a motor vehicle as opposed to driving a motor vehicle. We have bucket trucks that our line crews use for the purpose of restoring power and restoring utility service and performing routine maintenance on the utility system. Those are vehicles that are equipped with communications equipment as well as hydraulic equipment, which it's necessary to keep the motor running to be able to operate, for instance, the buckets that our crews get into to go up and actually repair the line. The way this is drafted, it refers to operating a motor vehicle as opposed to driving a motor vehicle. If we have a truck which is parked on a roadway, all roadways in the state are considered highways for the purpose of this bill. If we have a truck that's parked trying to put back up a down power line and there's a person in the bucket truck and they're calling back to the office or the operator is using the electronic communications or picking up the phone to talk about what we need to fix that outage, the way the bill is drafted, they would be operating the motor vehicle and using communications devices, and that would put them in violation of the law. We have very strong concerns to having our trucks not being able to do the work that they're required to do. I think during one recent storm, we restored power to some 90,000 customers in about 3 days. We see the work that we do as being pretty essential. We think that this is something that can be drafted, or the bill can be reworked to deal with this. We certainly don't want our crews, one, using cell phones while they're driving. We have language in our own policies, which we think mirrors pretty closely what's in the bill. We also don't want them operating their laptops or other, typing while they're driving, especially considering the size of these vehicles. So we very much don't want people driving and operating this equipment, but the language referring to operating the vehicle when a vehicle is parked, and even in some circumstances, you could have flaggers on either side of the vehicle keeping traffic away, and they'd still be in violation. So we support the intent, but unless the bill's amended, we're in a position of oppose unless amended. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, and that's why we have a hearing, so we find out these things that it's harder to think of everything. So any questions? Representative Springer, please.
I don't think this is really a question, and probably not fair for this panel to be in a position to have to answer. Similar conversation taking place that took place 6 years ago, listing exceptions, and I understand that. But if the premise of the data is that distracted driving is bad, the exception and how important that exception is does not change that data as we're putting in mm-hmm. exemptions. Now, certainly, if I'm rushing somebody I care about and love to the hospital because they're dying, I'm going to get on the phone. If you want to give me a ticket, you give me a ticket, and that's fine. I'm not going to worry about that. But a lot of the instances that we're hearing are not necessarily life or death. They're really important to us. And so as we talk about these exemptions, we need to understand we want to put them in. That's okay. But that does not change the value of the data for distracted driving.
Thank you.
Let me just please, comment, may, if I might, on that. We're not aware, within the amateur radio sector of this issue, we're not aware of any statistics, even on a national or state scale, that implicate amateur radio use with distracted driving and fatalities and car crashes. And, in fact, I think I heard law enforcement here just a minute ago suggests that we need to find a way to allow amateur radios involved in search and rescue and important public service events a way to help the community and serve the people of Oregon. So for our case, it's difficult to lump us in with the cell phone issues and that are the primary focus here. I don't think amateur radio really is the focus of what your legislation is trying to do. It's just sort of being caught up in it. But if we have this exemption that we're requesting and we have an FCC license in our pocket, then it's a clear situation for law enforcement. You just show them your license and take
so
care of it.
Let me ask you, too. So when we say amateur radio, we're talking about amateur radio, not CBs? And
right. And these are FCC-licensed amateur radio operators in the state of Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
May I clarify?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you for your indulgence. I'm not taking a shot at any one group. I just remember the conversation was the same, everybody coming in saying me too. And I'm not saying they're good or they're bad. I'm just saying I think it's important for the integrity of the bill to remember what this is about.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Chair. Yes, Representative Post.
Maybe a question for Representative Olson or Council, either one. Because, I'm sorry, what was your name again?
Amateur Radio, John Corr. Mr. Corr?
John. Yeah. Because of what John talked about, I've received I saved them all. I have a ton of emails from ham, emergency, FCC licensed radio guys that are very concerned about that whole. Basically, if you go from page one, the small A on line 26, so uses the mobile electronic device to communicate if the person, A, you have that description with or at the end, but then you have lines 5 through, I wrote them down, lines 6 through 23 are the ones that are being removed.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's giving these people heartburn, and
that's
it gives
right.
me heartburn.
That's right.
What was the reasoning for taking all of that out? Why couldn't it have stayed in and still have the intent of doing what we wanted to do, which is to stop people driving using their cell phones? It seems like this is extra.
So, Mr. Chair and President Post, the main drift of why these pieces were removed was moving toward what the National Highway Traffic Safety Association was. Am I not correct with that, Troy? Okay. And Troy might be able to speak to this, Costales, a little bit more to that. But that was some of the reasoning why we went with this direction.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative.
So if I may, that's probably correct as far as I understand it. So it's a bit of a trade-off here between what your goals are in the legislation if you want to be sure that the amateur radio community does have mobile radio communications that can be essential, really, to the state of Oregon in a disaster situation, then that's the trade-off.
Going to bring me food and water after the big one.
Yeah, so, you know, if we just had a clear exemption, as in the current law, it takes care of the issue.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch.
Well, if I could ask, would you say there's a distinction between people who've been using radios for their work for a long time and people who are using cell phones?
That are cell phone folks?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a big difference.
What's
you don't hold the radio up to your ear.
Right.
You have it mounted in the vehicle, usually on the dash or someplace permanently, right. Permanently installed there, and you've got a microphone. I just put it in my lap, and if I 90% of the time, I'm just listening to a channel on a repeater or some net frequency, and you just pick up the microphone and talk into it for a second and drop it in my lap. So it's not, it's not something you hold up in your to your ear all the time.
Following.
And it's duplex. There's a difference between duplex and like a conversation we're having right now.
Yeah, right.
And simplex, where you click the microphone to transmit and let go of it to receive. So in some cases, you could redefine what mobile communication is and put the word in, that it has to be duplex communications. Then you get into the issue of how does law enforcement tell whether it's duplex or simplex?
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Complicated. It's just simpler to have an exemption.
Mr. Chair, just one quick closing thing. So it seems to me, and certainly working in law enforcement, we were talking on the radio all the time, law enforcement officers know what to do and what not to do. And we were able to do that just fine without crashing. So it seems to me that perhaps people who've done this in not a cell phone way, but in a standard sort of way that he's speaking about, that they should be exempted from this bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, panel. Appreciate your testimony.
You.
Next call, Heather Noble and Roger Williamson. Please go ahead and just identify yourself for the record.
My name is Heather Noble. I'm with Salem Amateur Radio Club.
Okay. Roger Williamson, radio operator, and I also do volunteer search and rescue work and volunteer work with emergency management.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
My name is Heather Noble, and I am speaking on behalf of being opposed to the removal of our exemption for amateur radio to be able to transmit while operating a vehicle. And operating a vehicle, by what I understand, is any time that the engine is running. So when we are stationed at a disaster site, going between sites during drills, any type of operation of the equipment would be illegal. From the information I was able to find looking at other states, most recently Washington has gone back and added that ham radio is an exemption and allowing for us to communicate within the state of Washington. I could not find a state where it is illegal for ham radio operators, as we are licensed by the FCC and receive our license by taking individual tests. There are three different levels of ham radio operators, and those tests are graded and approval by the FCC to issue the actual license.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm in support of the bill as it proposed, you know, mainly distracted drivers. You know, we want to really take care of those and avoid the accidents that do occur from time to time. However, I'm seeking to that the exemption for ham radio operators that's in the current legislation remain there and is not pulled out of that. Due to the fact that you have radio operators that are able to report accidents while they're driving down the road, and in disaster work, search and rescue work, the bill that you're currently imposing would, in my estimation, actually create more harm than what you're trying to do here by not including the exemption for ham operators and, as like the sergeant with the sheriff's office said, for search and rescue, those type of volunteer activities that use radio to communicate in emergency situations. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. And next call, David Simons and Mark Wilson. Go ahead, Andy, or just identify yourself as you start to speak, please.
Am I first?
Or? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I'm Dave Simmons. I'm an electronic engineer and by happenstance, a ham radio operator. I've submitted some written testimony that explains why, in my view, this bill is a can of worms, basically. And I think you've heard quite a bit of that here. And quite a bit of what I'm saying in my written testimony, I think you've already heard here. A couple of things happened here in the hearing room that got my attention that I thought were very interesting. This gentleman here, I believe Representative Vial, reminded me of something. This is a voice recorder. And the message that you are sending about technology is that you don't want me to use this, but it's okay for me to write on a pad that's on my windshield with a suction cup. Now, that just doesn't make any sense. And the judge that was here circumscribed the problem that you really have very neatly. He's talking about people going down the road in the middle lane reading a newspaper. Now, the legislation that you need needs to be, and this is a point on which I disagree with him, the legislation you need needs to address the underlying issue of people either reading a newspaper or looking at a computer tablet in their lap or what have you. Whatever you pass needs to address the underlying problem with all of that, which is basically human behavior, okay? You're working on legislation that addresses technology, and that is symptomatic relief at best, if any. And if you look at my written testimony, you will see why I am convinced that it's not even symptomatic relief. Now, that said, I thought I would relate a couple of anecdotes. As I was saying, the real issue is not the much maligned technology, the physical devices, but the behavior of those using them. There's a wide spectrum of ability and capability among the drivers out here, and I think this gentleman here, Representative Gorsuch, addressed that somewhat when he referred to the fact that you don't have a problem with police officers operating radios. Now, in my case, I have a high degree of paranoia about my own personal awareness of what's going on the road. You know, I'll get to that in a moment, but almost anything distracts me. Even a radio on in the car distracts me from the level of awareness that I like to have when I'm driving. Now, on the other hand, I know a police officer who, like almost all of them, has a computer terminal in his vehicle, and he assures me he has no problem simultaneously listening to his police radio, watching his computer display, and driving, even while in pursuit of a fleeing suspect. Now, I don't know how this guy does it. Maybe he was a jet fighter pilot at one time. They are able to do such things, I assure you, and they have distractions coming at them that are far worse than anything anyone here can imagine. But my point again is that there's a wide variation in the capability of the drivers that you have out there, and a one-size-fits-all legislation such as this bill basically is just a ham-fisted attempt at a solution. It's basically going to fit nobody, or very few at most. Anyway, I think what has raised my awareness and caused me to become as alert as I am, hopefully, on the road, more than anything, surprisingly, is subscribing to Oregon State Police's flash alert reports. Because, I mean, I get every traffic accident that happens in the state that's reported on by OSP, at least. It shows up in my email. I look at these things, and the thing that's come home to me very clearly in this is that you look at these accidents where somebody's going down the road and somebody coming their way changes lanes on them. You literally have milliseconds to react to save your life and that of the people in your car. And really, what you need to do, and it's a tall order, is to establish that level of awareness in people that are going down the road in their cars. I think OSP has a great system there. I compliment them on making that available to the public. I wonder if maybe you shouldn't be putting simulators in the DMV offices and making people sit down and watch what this looks like when somebody's coming at them and use the simulation environment to make them aware of what the different distractions can do to you. I mean, as I was saying, it's a matter of milliseconds that you've got to react. Anyway, I'm rambling somewhat because I changed my verbal testimony here based on what I've seen in the room, some of which is very encouraging. As again, this gentleman over here, Representative Vial, seems to get it. from what I can tell, or at least what I've been trying to communicate. Anyway, I will end here, but I really encourage you not to focus on the technology and people's misuse of the technology in this. If you can solve the problem that encompasses both people going down the road reading a newspaper and getting distracted by any electronic device, you'll have your solution.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman and the committee, for the opportunity to speak. My name is Mark Wilson. I am an amateur radio operator, extra class, which is the highest. I am a former member and state director of the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps Military Auxiliary Radio Service, which is referred to as MARS. I'm currently a member and civil affairs officer for the Army MARS for the state of Oregon. I am former headquartered G2 intelligence for Oregon State Defense Force. I am currently the assistant J6 for communications for the headquarters for the Washington State Guard. I am communications unit leader all hazard for the U.S. Coast Guard District 13, which there are exactly three of them. I am the official emergency backup station for the Oregon State ECC, which is OEM. I am a communications first responder for the Department of Defense. And I am a member of the Oregon Office of Emergency Management Amateur Radio Unit. Forgive me a little bit here, because I only found out about this meeting about 2 hours ago. So I'm kind of doing this on the fly. On a personal note, in regards to cell phones, I carry a cell phone that usually is off due to me working in a high security field. In my cars, my radios are usually on for mission reasons and to report accidents and other issues on the road. I am most concerned with the public chilling effect on amateur radio and its effect on the various emergency communications users, especially the military auxiliaries. For a little better understanding, amateur radio developed spread spectrum frequency hopping technology, which is cell phones. That came from amateur radio. Amateur radio has had portable communications devices in their cars since the mid-1950s. I don't remember this being a big issue of crashing into things in the 50s, 60s, 70s, or beyond. In regards to military auxiliaries, maybe a better understanding of emergency communications in the United States, there are four levels. Amateur radio is the basic level. Military auxiliaries, which include the Civil Air Patrol, military MARS, the Coast Guard Auxiliary, and the State Guards, make up the second level. The third level is SHARES, which is the United States critical infrastructure, dams, communications companies, government entities, the military, such as that. And the fourth is FNARS, which is FEMA's National Radio Service. As a member of MARS, I am allowed to use all four of those levels. I am the only, this service, MARS, is the only one that's capable of doing all of those. We are orderable entities. As I was going through a class once with ICS 400, I think it was, we had Homeland Security, we had the Fire Marshal for Oregon, we had the National Guard, we had a number of different entities, and we were asking the question on 9/11, what's the difference between like amateur radio and a military auxiliary? On 9/11, if an order is given to go into the building that you know that is going to fall down, okay, the fire people will not. The Coast Guard, which are allowed to designate whether or not something is safe or unsafe, can make an individual decision. Police generally will not. Okay? As the National Guard guy and myself turn to each other, we have no choice. We go in because we're told to go in. That's the nature of our business, to save lives. Okay? Protect property. And it goes on and on. This particular regulation, as you've got it set up, makes no allowance for it. Many of us are amateur radio by definition because we may be required. For example, to be a member in MARS, you must have an amateur radio license. That is not required for Civil Air Patrol, which is Air Force frequencies, and it is not required for the U.S. Coast Guard, which is Coast Guard frequencies. Military auxiliaries basically use the communications for direction finding, especially people lost entities for the Coast Guard and such. We're generally holding a microphone with controls, but we can be sophisticated enough that we have a laptop up with full telemetry and satellite links, intra and internet connections that work whether or not the local connections within a 500-mile radius work. Okay? They can be open or they can be encrypted, all right, which makes them comply with HIPAA and PII standards. When there are casualties on the field, you can't use other entities. It can do telemetry, mapping, active coordinating, signal and communications displays, and we also have communications packs, which are big boxes that we stick in the car, we hook some wires to, and lo and behold, it gives us an additional capability. By the definition of your rules, that doesn't work for us. It is not permanently mounted in the car. Okay, it's stuck in the trunk, and it's got a lot of wires spreading out of it, and it may rattle around, but it is not permanently mounted. Okay? Our job, and the thing I worry about this regulation as it is currently, we cannot do our job protecting the public with active and continuous radio access and communications in a wide variety of forms, as the rule currently is designed. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate that, the expertise there. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on the House Bill 2597, and we'll do a little more work on that before we bring it back. And no further business. Committee stands adjourned. Thank you, committee. And no further business. Committee stands adjourned. Thank you, committee.